Welcome to Mintcast, the podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. This is episode 428, recorded on Sunday, January 7th, 2024. 290 for sets of two, I'm Joe.
Slowly recovering, I'm Moss.
Christmas is over, time to start shopping for overpriced chocolates and day spa gift certificates. I'm Bill.
Trying to figure out what else to buy, I'm Majid.
And not quite ready to go back to normal life, I'm Eric.
First up in the news, Mint Monthly News, Fedora Sahi Remix officially released for Apple Silicon Macs and others. In security and privacy, nothing. Then in our wanderings, Bill makes unstable, Majid bricks and unbricks, Moss is counting pixels, Joe does a lot, like a lot, and Eric does some homebrewing.
Yes, and I'm becoming unstable, not...
No, you are unstable.
What did you say? Makes unstable?
Like becomes
bubble,
unstable.
Bubble, that's toil, what it says. And trouble.
It says, Bill becomes unstable, so you are unstable.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
First up in the news, Mint Monthly News from the Linux Mint blog by Clem via Londoner. Clem started by wishing everyone Happy New Year and thanking them for all the donations. In December, 24,146 was received from 751 people. In addition, Linux Mint is proudly supported by 945 patrons for a sum of $3,300 per month. To become a Linux Mint patron, please visit the link in the show notes. The beta phase for Linux Mint 21.3 has been relatively quiet. 50 bug reports were received and 35 of them are already closed. The remaining 15 are being tackled and preparations made for a stable release and an upgrade path. The ISOs entered QA testing on Friday, so a stable release won't be long. LMDE6 will receive all the new updates featured in Linux Mint 21.3. This will happen shortly before the stable release. During beta testing, compatibility issues were identified between Linux Mint and newer hardware devices, such as recent AMD graphics, but also wireless chipsets and SSD controllers used in Acer laptops. These are solved by upgrading the kernel series from 5.15 to 6.5. Therefore, a new Edge ISO for Linux Mint 21.3, shipping with a kernel 6.5, will be forthcoming. And if we have nothing to say about that, then over to Majid.
Okay, then. So, going to one of our favorite news articles. Fedora Sahi Remix officially released for Apple Silicon Macs. So this is from the Asahi Linux and also 95 Linux via Londoner. On December 19th, Asahi Linux officially introduced what they describe as the most polished Linux for Apple Silicon Macs. Fedora Asahi Remix is the result of a close multi-year collaboration between Asahi Linux project and the Fedora project. All of the Asahi platform-specific packages are in the upstream Fedora and are fully supported in Fedora Linux 39. All M1, M2 series MacBook, Mac Mini, Mac Studio, and iMac devices are supported. KDE Plasma is offered as the flagship desktop environment, but it is possible to use GNOME 45. Fedora Asahi Remix comes right out of the box with 100% Wayland environment with high DPI support, even across multiple displays with different display scales, and X-Wayland included. With upcoming improvements, new technologies such as HDR and display notches will be supported. Asahi have also pioneered the world's fully integrated DSP solution for the desktop Linux ecosystem using Pipewire and WirePlumber with their in-house Bankstown base boost technology. So this is great news, I think. It also kind of torpedoes one of my predictions because this was going to be one of my predictions for 2024. Does anybody know if this is a proper 1.0 release, or are we still beta?
Good question.
Because I think that would be interesting to know. Are they saying that, because they've said it's the most polished Linux for Apple Silicon Macs, but does that mean it is one which is now fully working?
Well, I thought Asahi was still beta, so anything built on top of Asahi is still going to be beta, but I don't know for certain.
I see no version numbers on their website.
Because I just think that would be, because maybe too much is made out of version numbers, but I do think it's very telling if a company puts, you know, 1.0 instead of 0.8 or 0.7
Londoner says
or whatever.
It's a proper release of Asahi.
Okay. Well, okay. Has anybody, I mean, I've got rid of my M1 Mac book. Has anybody else got any M1 M series devices that could try this out on?
You mean buy a Mac?
Yeah, no.
I don't know.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, okay. All right. So I suppose that's just going to be good news, but nothing that we've actually got any proper experience with.
I'll be more interested in this when inevitably Apple drops support for these devices, starting with the M1 when it came out, and then the Linux side will be basically the only up-to-date option that you've got. And how well will that run, given the fact that Apple is no longer supporting the Apple...
That might take a long time.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's really going to be a long time. I mean, we're looking at probably, what, 7-8 years from now, probably?
Right, ooh. But
I mean, the M1 MacBook Air came out in 2020. It seems that these devices last almost a decade.
Yeah, but Apple makes the devices that actually do, like, usually work for long periods of time. I mean, or is still relevant for long periods of time. The 2012 MacBook was still relevant until, what, 2019? So 7-8 years of usability. And the screens were awesome and the processor was decent. Yeah, the RAM was a little bit short, but it was still a good device.
Right.
So I think, yeah, that's... The worry that I have with all of these, because I have, as I said, having had a short experience with Macs, is that you're always a little bit, it's not as easy as it is on, say, a Windows box to be putting a Linux distro on anyway, even if you've got an Intel powered Mac. You know, there's always some complications because everything's closed source, everything's Apple, it's all integrated, vertically integrated. So it just seems like, you know, you're basically got to have more money than sense if you think to yourself, I'm going to buy an M1 Mac and I am happy if this completely dies while I try and put on a Linux distro.
I'm glad you said it before I did.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I don't have sense, and I don't have money either. I'm losing on both. But yeah, I mean, when I had the old MacBook Pro, I think it was the 2017 one, I was happy to put Linux onto that, because I thought, well, at least I should be able to go back relatively easily. And it wasn't actually that easy, compared to, as I said, Linux Windows boxes. I did not have the cojones to try that on the M1.
Now, I have a question. Isn't the M1 and M2, aren't they like ARM adjacent?
Like, no, they are ARM.
They are ARM. Okay, but I thought they were like Apple's version of ARM.
Well, I mean, they are obviously Apple's custom-made silicon, but they are ARM designs. Fundamentally, the structure is ARM as opposed to, you know, x86, you know,
right.
Structure.
And so the instruction set is different, and each ARM chip... other places are different, but because the M1 and M2 are ubiquitous for Apple, it's easier to get Linux running on them than it is each individual ARM processor that's out there. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
right.
Once we get through and Asahi actually gets fully established, I know Londoner said that they had a release, but it being, you know, I would still say early in the M1, M2 cycle, it's still going to be a while before they're highly polished.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is having to redo it all from the ground up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hard to polish whenever you're literally building the floor underneath of the house, you know. Right. The work they're doing is really reverse engineering, you know, figuring out how to support this hardware without any help from the original maker, which is a Linux forte. I mean, that's kind of what Linux has always been good at. Let's take a toaster and get Linux to run on it. And, you know, because it's not supposed to, first of all, and because we want to.
Well, we need to remember that the Asahi people were the first to come out with a real legitimate Mesa driver for this hardware. They even beat Apple on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so they're deep in the innards of the hardware at this point. So polish, yeah, I would expect that to come a little bit later.
Eric, you're up.
Yes, sir. GNOME makes new system monitor extension for GNOME Shell. And this is from OMG Ubuntu. Keeping an eye on CPU, memory, and network activity in GNOME Shell is easy thanks to an array of community-built extensions tailor-made for the task. Now a new option is available for GNOME Shell users, one designed, developed, and supported by GNOME itself. Why create its own resource monitor add-on? GNOME developer Florian Mulner explains, a long time ago we used to include a system monitor extension that added CPU memory graphs to the long-gone message tray. However, demand for this type of extension hasn't died down to the point where RHEL includes a revived version of the old extension. In light of the continued need, they've built a brand new system monitor extension. The new iteration is unlikely to suffer from the CPU and memory flaws found in the old version. This extension, like all GNOME-made ones, is entirely optional and is not part of GNOME Shell itself, so if you have no use for it, you needn't fret. The reason I wanted to include this, and the reason I thought it was interesting, is because there's always sort of this contention from the GNOME team and the third-party developers who build extensions. You know, they will sometimes have breaking changes and you know, not necessarily give the extension developers plenty of time to adjust to it. And depending on what type of GNOME user you are, you might see the extensions as being superfluous and completely unnecessary, or completely necessary and couldn't use GNOME without it. And I'm in that latter camp. And to me, this just sort of legitimizes extensions a little bit more whenever you have GNOME themselves kind of saying, hey, the community has actually said this is something we need, to the point where RHEL is doing this work themselves. And of course, there's a close relationship between the GNOME Foundation and RHEL. And so it's not too surprising that GNOME would, you know, maybe write this themselves. But the thing I like is, again, this more or less legitimizes extensions, the fact that extensions exist, that they're useful, that they can provide functionality above and beyond just the sort of default vision of what GNOME is. So,
I'm just wondering how mad they're going to be when they break their own extension. It's also been said that there are at least 15 other extensions out there now doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, there are. Absolutely. One of them is called Vitals, which is probably the preeminent one. And it does this and way, way more as well. But you always have that blessing of an official extension versus, you know, third party. So,
I mean, the thing that I mean, I'm a GNOME user. I like GNOME, especially on touchscreens and tab and laptops and things like that, which I've mentioned ad nauseum. I've always been a little bit confused by what the GNOME team's view of extensions is. Because you see, for example, you'll see certain videos and guides on the internet talking about how, you know, GNOME is customizable. You just need to, you know, install this extension, that extension. You can make it exactly the way that you want to. And yet, as you know, the joke always goes, you know, they, you know, these extensions regularly break. So yeah, I do wonder what's GNOME's vision when it comes to these extensions.
I don't think there's a consensus among the GNOME team as to what their attitude towards the extensions should be. I think you'll hear one voice come out and speak either for or against it, and then that one voice seems to, like, take on the personality of the entire GNOME team, and it causes a lot of controversy. It causes a lot of conversation among people like us and that. And then another voice will come out completely contradictory. So I think there are people who've fundamentally disagree with each other within, you know, the higher ups of the development team, and that's what causes kind of a bit of confusion, you know, when we get to talking about these things, because we'll see an article like this one week, and then a couple weeks later, we see an article where a developer is saying that we need to get rid of the whole thing altogether, you know. So,
I mean, as I said, I mean, I am quite happy with the customizability that GNOME has out of the box anyway. I've just got a bit older and I can't be bothered to theme and skin things as much as I used to. So what is kind of natively in GNOME is fine by me. And there are a couple of extensions I use, but not many. It's not really a big thing. But as I said, I'm just wondering about it from a kind of, because they talk a big game about design UX. They talk a big game about, you know, what their vision is. And so I would have thought to have a consistent idea of, because then if you are like, okay, fine, we're just going to give you a base system and then you add all whatever you want to make it the way that you want it to be, that's fine. Then why don't you support your extensions better? Or if you say, no, look, you know, they do an Apple. This is the way it's going to be. And if you like it, great. And if you don't like it, KDE's over there. Then again, that's fine, because then at least you know what you're signing up for, you know.
But even Apple, there are ways to, in Windows, you can have third-party applications that change the menus, change the structure, change the icons, change, and whatever it is you're interested in doing. And I think really the complication for the GNOME team is, for that, they really would be in a tough position if they were to officially embrace and support extensions, because that is such a large community of developers, of users, of people who are doing things that are well outside of like the core of what they're trying to do, that, you know, so on one hand, it's like, okay, we kind of get that there are use cases, and even there are, you know, System 76 making Pop! OS for the last several years, where they rely heavily on their own custom extensions to do things to the desktop. Same thing with Ubuntu. Ubuntu doesn't ship vanilla GNOME. And so there's already sort of this contentious, maybe not contentious, but there's already this definite admission that the GNOME way or the GNOME vision of their desktop is lacking, at least in some instances and some use cases. And extensions are the way that they get from that vanilla experience to what, you know, the distro wants to provide to their users. Now, it's up to the distro or the developers of the extension to manage that. And if there's a breaking change, oh well, because it's not up to GNOME to support those, and they can't be stymied and stifled. Think of Microsoft, the situation they've been in for the last 30 years of needing to support every stupid executable that was ever created for Windows 95, 97, XP, all the way through. You know, they've had to have this backwards compatibility, and how difficult it is for them to maintain that code base because of exactly that. If every time they came out with a new version, they just had carte blanche to say, we do what we want. And if you guys are doing something that you want to do, well, then it's up to you to maintain that and fix it. If we break it, oh well. And, you know, companies like Microsoft can't do that because people pay them a lot of money for that backward compatibility, whereas GNOME isn't in that position. So I think that's kind of the relationship, is that they recognize that some people have a need to extend the desktop beyond what they're comfortable doing or want to support, but they don't want to be in the position of having to be responsible for it.
I mean, it just seems a bit confusing, really. And you just kind of, then you're kind of, you know, you're I don't know which metaphor to use, but basically, you know, you're not making anybody happy. You're not making the people who want a consistent experience happy, and you're not making the people who want to customize it happy. So, you know, well, what's that thing about, you know, you can only please some of the people some of the time. If you try and please all the people all the time, you'll please none of them none of the time.
It's hard to argue that GNOME isn't the most popular and preeminent desktop environment in the Linux desktop.
Oh, no, I agree entirely. And as I said, I say this as a GNOME user. I say this as I like GNOME. I just wanted a bit of clarity. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah.
I think we've probably beaten that one to death, I think, haven't we, really?
It was good, though.
Go on, Bill. You're next, it looks like.
Yeah. All right. So FWUPD, that's the firmware updater, 1.9.11 released with support for new AlgoTech and LuxShare USB devices. Last month, LVFS/FWPD celebrated serving more than 100 million firmware updates to Linux users, while today, FWPD 1.9.11 has shipped as the latest update to this open source firmware updating solution. FWPD 1.9.11 adds improved handling for ignoring recovery partitions during ESP selection, checking for CET and SMAP presence on AMD, that's non-Intel x86 CPUs, faster Synaptics MST device enumeration, and a variety of other fixes on the new hardware. Support front FWPD 1.9.11 adds support for AlgalTech USB devices and the LuxShare Quad USB 4 dock. An engineer from AlgalTech, let's hope that's the last time I got to say that, I fear it's not, contributed to the new AlgalTech USB plugin for FWPD to handle updating the AlgalTech ASIC firmware. Initially, this supports firmware updates for AlgalTech's DisplayPort over USB-C to HDMI converter. The LuxShare Quad USB 4 dock support for firmware updating comes via extending the Synaptics MST plugin for supporting that dock. FWPD previously was targeting LuxShare Quad support, but in version 1.9.11, additional changes are needed around the device requiring the manual restart after the firmware update to properly complete. And that's good news.
That was a good job.
Yeah, thanks. So that sounded like crap.
You did good. But I think the most important thing and the most impressive part of that, and the reason I wanted to include it, was that last month they celebrated serving more than 100 million firmware updates to Linux users. I have to tell you, using Windows versus using Linux, the firmware updates on Linux have become so easy. The idea of just Linux popping up and telling me, hey, your Dell laptop has a new firmware version available. And it's just like, oh, okay, well, that's neat. What's in there? And it even tells you the details. It's like, it's something that we can enjoy on Linux that I just, there are definitely utilities you can run on Windows and different ways you can enable that type of functionality, but it's not something that's just that easily accessible.
Every one of them tells you that you could possibly bork your entire system by installing that firmware update.
Well, they have to tell you that. Yeah. That all being said, I had to disable it on my wife's laptop because she dual boots with Windows 11. And Windows 11 does not like it when another operating system updates firmware. And then it tries to start.
I've never had that problem.
I don't know what I've got set up differently. It's running Kubuntu, but every time FWPD changes anything, Windows 11 starts up. And probably because I don't have any of the secure boot or the TPM disabled or anything. And it sees that there's a different firmware version, then I have to go and do that stupid BitLocker thing where you go to Microsoft and unlock it. So it'll boot again, and sometimes it happens when I'm on the road and I just can't be bothered with it. So it's one of those things that's fantastic for Linux users, but there is these weird edge cases like what I just described. So it's fantastic that we have this because we went a very long time, in my opinion, without something like this. We just were stuck with whatever BIOS version or firmware that we had at the time that we installed the software. Well,
and also the fact that it encompasses so many different pieces of hardware. Like the one you might have on Windows may, tell you that your system has a BIOS update or a firmware update, but, not your peripheral or not your, and the fact that a developer from AlgalTech or LuxShare or whoever can come to the, LVFS and say, hey, we want to include our hardware in this. Like, that's really convenient. Very cool. Sorry, Joe, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No worries. But at least it's been a couple of years since Microsoft has, you know, overwritten my boot partition. Yes, that used to be a thing.
And I've noticed that Windows, like, and it really only becomes a problem when you're doing a lot of booting from USB devices or dual booting and that. But sometimes Windows on an update will change your boot order. I mean, it's they've got full access to the UEFI, you know, so I don't know. It irritates me, but there's so few machines running Windows in this house and Linux.
I just thought of a story, and I'm so sorry that I forgot to include it. I'm going to let Moss do his, but then I want to talk about, if you guys want to, the idea that Microsoft is adding a new button on a keyboard for the first time in 30 years.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Button, who's got the button? AI, the future.
On to Moss.
Okay, Debian preps ground to drop 32-bit x86 as a separate edition. After a recent meetup in Cambridge, Debian developers are discussing how to start gradually dropping 32-bit x86 support. At the end of November, some of the Debian development team met at a mini-debconf in Cambridge, UK. One immediately visible result is a message entitled Bits from the Release Team on the Debian-Devel-Announce mailing list. With significant news, the end of the line for Debian as a 32-bit distro is approaching. Note, though, this doesn't mean that 32-bit support is going away altogether, not yet anyway. The news is in a section titled, A Future for the i386 Architecture. Insofar as they still do, we anticipate that the kernel, D-I, and images teams will cease to support i386 in the near future. There is a bit of internal project jargon here, which we suspect bears clarifying. First, i386 is the Debian project's term for what we call x86-32. If x86-64 is 64-bit, aka x64, then x86-32 is 32-bit x86. Simple. Also, this i386 doesn't mean that the actual 80386 from the 1980s, the Linux kernel dropped support for that way back in 2012. Most OS projects now talks about i686, which is generally taken to mean 32-bit Intel chips from the original Pentium Pro or Pentium 2 onward. We suspect that kernel is fairly self-explanatory, although you may not know that the Debian project includes a number of kernels, of which the Linux kernel is only one. The abbreviation D-I means the Debian installer, and images is the project's term for installable CD and DVD media.
Now, I know that we all find that the 32-bit getting dropped entirely is a little bit disappointing, but how many of us are actually still using 32-bit machines?
Well, I do know that Debian, that Bode is still making a 32-bit based on Bode. I can't even think. Based on Debian, and that they are also going to start doing a 64-bit based on Debian that they're terming Debode.
Doesn't MX Linux, isn't that based on MX Debian as well? So basically that'll mean all these things will kind of quietly go away. Is the time right for this? I mean, I've not installed anything on a 32-bit machine in years.
Well, if there's a need for it, someone will develop it. So, all right, well, that is it for our news. And according to our security and privacy, we are officially 100% secure.
Update your software, folks.
Do you guys want to talk about the Copilot?
Oh, yeah, key? I'm sorry. I forgot.
It's okay. I'm going to stick it in there. It's okay. I'm going to stick it in there as a...
Because this is an interesting story, and I have to wonder what, somebody in Linux is going to make of this button.
I'm just going to map it to something stupid.
It's going to be my new VLC launcher.
Oh, the stickers that they're going to make for it.
I keep meaning to order those stickers for the Microsoft key on all
my
computers.
I've got a bunch of those. I've got Arch ones. I've got Linux ones.
The Penguin key, yep.
I wonder if you could map it to a competitor's AI, like Google Bard.
Yeah, I don't know why you wouldn't.
Or Mozilla's.
No, Mycroft.
That would be big, wouldn't it?
Really
sadly, they terminated the Mycroft project.
Anyway, go on then, Eric. You want to...
I pulled it from TechCrunch. Everybody covered it, but So this is Microsoft wants to add a Copilot key to your PC keyboard from TechCrunch. Microsoft would like 2024 to be the year of the AI PC, and to put a point on that, the company today announced a new key for Copilot that is a physical key that will soon make its way to your keyboard and join the Windows key together with its friends, the Control key, Alt, and the Insert key that you've never purposely used. Based on the image Microsoft sent over, it looks like the new Copilot key will replace the right control key on the standard PC keyboard, where it will slot in between the Alt key and the left arrow key. The introduction of the Copilot key, and this is a quote, marks the first significant change to the Windows PC keyboard in nearly three decades. Microsoft's Youssef Mehdi, Executive Vice President and Consumer Chief Marketing Officer, writes in today's announcement, "We believe it will empower people to participate in the AI transformation more easily." The AI transformation, wow. The Copilot key joins
That's
the Windows
key. That's where we all turn into logical machines.
I'm hearing the Terminator song in my head right now.
Yikes. Yeah, right. Copilot key. The Copilot key joins the Windows key as a core part of the PC keyboard when pressed. The new key will invoke the Copilot and Windows experience to make it seamless to engage Copilot in your day-to-day. Oh, my goodness.
Not going to happen.
So, you know.
Well, I mean, it will happen. Nobody will use it.
Hey, Cortana.
You know.
There will be. The Copilot button will be there. It's just that nobody will use it.
I don't even use the transformation.
I've got the right super button on this keyboard, and I never use that, so.
Look,
problem for me is I actually use the control key. On the right side. I use it a lot.
So do I. Yeah, I actually use the right control key.
Oh, yeah.
This lovely keyboard here is actually a Japanese keyboard. And it's got three extra keys. And I have remapped them to do various things.
Yeah.
Nice. Where did you get a Japanese keyboard?
Well, the same place you would get one. eBay.
Oh, okay. Like, when I was in Japan, I made sure I bought a keyboard. Oh, my goodness. Well, I have to give it to Microsoft for when they go all in on something, they go all in. And, you know, they've invested heavily in, you know, into ChatGPT and OpenAI and, you know, the way that there was that corporate shakeup at OpenAI, where Microsoft basically was ready
corporate
to walk
shakeup.
In.
Corporate shakeup. I think that's a little bit of an understatement.
Well, you know,
it was the craziest shit I've ever seen.
It was the
seen.
Craziest 48 hours in the history.
That was yeah. absolutely nuts. I mean,
that
put it
madness.
This way: the Verge had multiple emergency podcasts, each of which was out of date by the time it was published. So, yes, calling it a slight kerfuffle maybe is a bit under understatement. Anyway, sorry.
By the time we could talk about it, it was all old news because, yeah. you know, it took that
Everybody
long.
Everybody had talked about it?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
So now I can imagine that everyone I know who has a new computer at some point when this key is on there, who accidentally presses the key and gets this thing they don't want, the first thing they're going to ask me is, how do I disable it?
Is it going to be on like general purpose machines and keyboards, or is it just
all of them.
Microsoft products?
All of them.
All of them.
Anything that ships with Windows.
I don't think.
Any keyboard that's Windows certified is going to have this Copilot key.
Well, that's me not buying any more Windows certified keyboards.
Well, the first one I heard of, so that Dell made a bunch of changes to their XPS line, which is kind of disappointing because I've been a fan of the XPS line for a long time. And excuse me, there I saw that the mock-up of the new one has the Copilot key on it and a really weird keyboard as well, so I won't be buying any more anyway. But hopefully stuff like this will leave such a bad taste in people's mouth, like you just said, like I'm not buying anymore, that it pushes people towards smaller manufacturers, you know, the System 76s of the world, or what's the
Tuxedo Slimbook.
The one where everybody can the one you can change everything around.
Oh,
I can't think of Right?
Frameworks.
It's like, duh.
Framework.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Framework. Yes. Which I'm seriously considering Framework for my next laptop because, you know, it is cool and they seem to have a really good policy with open source and Linux. So,
I mean, though, how much different is this than when they decided to start putting the Windows button for the start menu on the keyboard? Honestly, though,
I don't know.
Max already had the Clover key.
Yeah. I mean, we just use it for our own purposes, you know, so we'll just use that
I mean, being the first one in such a long time, it definitely is newsworthy from the standpoint of, like, that's a big change.
Yeah, it is.
That's a whole systemic change, you know, that's been the same for decades. So, well, good for them. We'll see how that AI transformation goes.
Hey, is the open Apple and the closed Apple keys still around? Does anybody remember those?
No. Why, does one have a bite out of it and the other one don't?
No, one of them was hollow and the other one wasn't. The other one was filled in.
Huh.
I think it was the Apple OE2s that had that keyboard.
You must just be older than me.
No, I must have just been using computers way younger than you.
Probably.
Hard to argue with that. All right.
Okay, so now we are on, finally, officially, on to the bi-weekly wanderings. And first up, Bill.
So the holidays are over, and it's time to get back to the business of everyday life, such as it is.
Boo.
I didn't have much time off, as it were, but I did have three-day weekends for both Christmas and New Year. With the exception of Three Fat Truckers, my podcasting responsibilities have been less than demanding. So I decided to get a couple of things done that's been on the back burner. First, I wanted to master the art of marrying Debian SID or Unstable with LMDE6. Hold your hate mail, folks, please. I've tried this in the past with less than stellar results. This time I determined to get it working properly. As a Linux user, I've always seemed to fit more firmly into the category of a rolling release user, hence my affinity with distributions like Arch. And I see now that there's absolutely no way to avoid telling people when you run Arch, so I'm not even going to try anymore.
Run Arch?
Yeah, I do. I do. I run Arch.
Okay.
There, all right. I said it. I finally said it.
Finally, the truth came out.
I thought the bird was used.
Wow, that didn't take very long for Arch to get mentioned.
Arch users, I should have put that in a prediction. I mean, how long would it take for Bill to mention he uses Arch?
There's just no way to avoid it in conversation because every experience
has got
something to do.
Obviously.
I mean, Arch users.
I use Arch supports in my shoes.
Well, there, you should have been telling us about that. Arch users are philosophically aside from other types of users. So whenever you find yourself explaining your insane methods to people, somehow you always end up just admitting your affiliation. At that point, normal Linux users just say, ah, and then from then on out, treat you as though you have Tourette syndrome. Anyway, this time I was determined to die on my hill.
Have you mentioned in the last 30 seconds that you run Arch?
I don't know. How long's it been? Anybody keeping track? I don't have a stopwatch. Anyway, this time I was determined to die on my hill. After some research, I learned one fundamental mistake I was making was that I was using the command sudo apt update and sudo apt full upgrade. The second of those is the modern equivalent to the old sudo apt get dist upgrade command, which will not only upgrade packages, but also uninstall and clear from the cache packages app believes are no longer needed. That's maybe an oversimplified way to describe what it does. The Debian documentation suggests not using this command when using SID because it can cause instability. And they are right. When I tried this back in the LMDE5 days, I ended up with a broken system with half of Cinnamon gone. This time, I avoided the potentially destructive command, and everything is brilliant. For all intents and purposes, I've recaptured some of what I love about Arch while also keeping the Mint tooling and securing my place as a Mint user. That same lizard brain that likes using Arch, Nextcloud, Jellyfin, and Docker will not allow me to be a host of Mintcast without actually running Mint. I'm told it may be an indicator for OCD. I don't care. It's my world, and I'm living right here. The thing that I like best is the access to up-to-date content creation software without the use of any containerized so-called universal solutions, which, with the exception of OBS Studio, all seem to be half-baked and in lots of ways somewhat broken. These are opinion, folks. Just calm down. One potential pitfall I am slightly concerned with is the Debian freeze, which occurs just before a stable release to keep the package repo steady in line with the image creation schedule. I'm not really aware of how long this freeze usually lasts, and I've heard some say it can be a potential worst-case scenario situation if a vulnerability materializes. This is because if a problem arises during the freeze, the patch won't get merged until after the end of the freeze. The same is true for Debian testing branch as well. Time will tell if this is a solution I can commit to for the long term. I will definitely comment more on it in the future. One other thing I wanted to get done was my daughter's laptop. She's been running Windows 10 on her 15-inch HP Omen with a 6th-generation i5. Although this machine has both Secure Boot and TPM 2.0, it is still blacklisted by Windows 11. This is where Ventoy enters the story. With Ventoy, you essentially create a bootable USB thumb drive with their tool. It can be done on Windows as well as Linux. Then you put whatever ISOs you want on the drive. In this case, I'd put both Windows 10 and 11 on the drive just in case I couldn't get 11 to work. I could at least give her a clean new install of Windows 10. Ventoy has an option made just for 11 where it bypasses the automatic check to see if the machine is eligible for the OS and gets straight to the eligible for the OS and gets straight to the installation. Everything working perfectly, and now she is enjoying a much better experience for her gaming. And it did work. I'm going to talk a little bit more about Ventoy in the Check This Out, because it's not 100% clear in the beginning how you get past it. It also offers an option to skip over signing into a Microsoft account, but you got to know how to get past that, and it's not immediately clear how you do that. But anyways, I got it working for her, and I also replaced the combination 128GB NVMe drive and the 1TB spinning Rust with a brand new 2TB NVMe and upgraded her 8GB of RAM to 32GB. She went from having a noticeably weaker machine as compared to her brother's to one slightly superior in terms of storage capacity and available RAM. And I added this yesterday because yesterday morning I transplanted the server that's running the Jellyfin instance, 3 of the websites I administer, my audio bookshelf server, and the reverse proxy that sits literally between the internet and all of these services. I got up at like 4:30 in the morning and started doing this, thinking it would be the best time to do a machine transplant, and almost immediately got a message from Londoner saying that our website was down and the Nextcloud wasn't working either. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. He's on the other side of the earth. The reason I did it was because the tower, my Dell PowerEdge T40, it was one of the noisiest boxes I've ever ran. So I ordered an Antec P101, which is an absolute beast of a tower. It's this thing sitting behind me that looks like a refrigerator. It's about a third bigger than the ThinkCenter. And prior to this, the ThinkCenter was probably about 3 or 4 inches bigger in both directions than the Dell tower it came in. And you see how much bigger this thing is. Another great feature is that all of the walls are lined with sound dampening. And It comes standard with 8 3.5-inch bays, which is probably part of the reason it's so big, is I can put 8 drives in it, though I'm only using 3 of them. But that's still, I'm able to separate them and get good airflow. But it's just dead quiet. It's got 4 fans running, and you've got a switch on the top where you can change the speed of the fans. And it's got, like, if I open the door right here, there's a screen I can pull off and then wash that screen off and put it back in and keep the fans somewhat clean that way. But it's just silent. That other thing was just driving me nuts. In the near future, I'm going to order another one and then transplant this one as well. That way there's 2 of them the same size there. Anyway, that's what I got going on. What you got, Joe?
Well, a new drinking game. Try not to die. Every time one of us mentions Arch, take a shot.
Ooh, I gotta get some whiskey.
All right. Now, I have done some more messing around with Android and have a couple of different things to talk about in that regard. I was having some issues with hooking up a Bluetooth keyboard and touchpad to my phone, and I really wasn't sure why. I've hooked them up to it in the past, but I have a lot of devices that were remembered in my Bluetooth list due to the amount of headphones that I test. I looked up several fixes for the issue, but the one that ended up working for me was resetting the network information, which did clear all of my Bluetooth items, which probably needed to be done, and also all of my Wi-Fi networks, which was not needed. It is good that I can now use a Bluetooth keyboard and touchpad and can hook up the headsets that I use the most, but yeah, putting back in all the networks as I come across them has been fun. I've also still... Oh, it all moved. I can't see anything. I'm not saying it was you, buddy. Okay. I've also still been using Dex when I can at work, but something that I have noticed is that it is very hit or miss if the touchscreen will work on the second monitor. A few times it has worked, and a few times I get nothing. I have tried disconnecting and reconnecting, I have tried to restart, I have tried different cables, and I'm not sure what actually causes it to work or not. It makes it really hard to test and really hard to fix. But the separate...
What device are you using for Dex? Is this your Note 10 still?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So you're connecting it to the second screen by USB, am I right?
Yes, that is correct. That one is micro.
Okay. I'm just trying to think why the touchscreen wouldn't be working, that's all.
Yeah, it's hit or miss on whether or not it works. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I've tried different cables. That doesn't seem to help. Disconnecting, reconnecting. Turning everything off, turning it back on, restarting. It's just completely random whether or not the touchscreen works.
How big is the second screen you're using?
It's, it's a 8-inch screen, 9-inch screen?
Okay.
It's barely bigger than the phone, okay. But it is still helpful.
Okay.
When you say random, you mean it's the same device randomly works, yeah, and doesn't work, or some...
Correct. The touchscreen on the device, on the second screen.
But it's the same screen you're talking about, just whether or not...
Right, the second screen that I hook up to my phone has a touchscreen.
Right.
And sometimes that touchscreen works, and then sometimes it doesn't.
But it's always the same screen.
And I'm not certain why. Correct.
Yeah, okay. I wonder whether Android in the past, and especially Samsung's One UI, whatever, had... It used to have kind of like the problem that old Windows installs used to have, you know, registry things getting added and cruft will get added and it would just slow down and you'd get random errors and whatever. And I remember that was when I stopped buying Samsung. I remember I buying the Galaxy S8 and after 3 months thinking, shit, I need to factory reset this because it's just slowed down so much. And then I thought, you know what might be better? Not buying another Samsung. I mean, admittedly, I have bought Samsung since, but I mean, that was one of the reasons that I, you know, changed brands and, you know, try lots of different things now as it is. Now, Samsung has got a lot better at that. And Android has got a lot better at that in general. But it's interesting because the reason why I've been asking questions about it is because, my main phone at the moment is a OnePlus 11. That's my home, as in my, you know, my personal device. And I've started noticing that jank come up and the kind of random slowdowns and stuff like this that I remember from about 4 or 5 years ago on Samsung devices. So I suppose there is still, you know, if you keep something for long enough or something that's not optimized for long enough, I suppose, you know, you will get a bit of gremlins in the back, I suppose. Because, I mean, the Note 10 is 4 years old now?
It's like 5 years old now.
Okay.
4.5, I think, because I got it when it first came out, and I know that they just stopped sending updates out to it. But, yeah, I haven't done a factory reset on it since I got it. So maybe that would help. I don't know.
How fast does Dex work with it? I mean, is it pretty quick?
Yeah, it's pretty quick.
Oh, good.
I would say that the slowdown on that is actually the screen turning on when you plug it in, because it's also powered from the hub. So,
okay.
Yeah. I've got the exact same phone Joe has, and I use the Dex, although it's a slightly different configuration, because what I've got is basically one of those cables. It's HDMI on one end and USB-C on the other.
I just
run that to a TV because I'm just using it to play content, and it works brilliantly for that. So you've got to use the phone itself for the input, which is,
well,
it is what
I
it
also,
is.
I also have another screen, but I think that's further on in my talking that I will get to, that has some issues, but I think it's related to it being a lower cost device. So, but yeah, even with that smaller screen and being just barely larger than like the size of my phone, I can adjust the scaling on that separately to make things a little bit bigger on that screen. And the Dex setup allows me to do split screen, so I can do some multitasking at work. It doesn't violate any of my work policies because it's literally my phone on another screen. So I do like it. It's just quirky here and there. So I moving on from that, I finally did the work and put that M.2 hard drive into my server to replace the SSD that was there. I think I bought it like 2 years ago and then just hadn't done it. So it went from a 500 gigabyte to a 1 terabyte and greatly increased the read-write speed. The startups times are just brilliant. At the same time, I also received a very powerful graphics card from Bill. Thank you, Bill. So that also went in since I was doing a nuke and pave anyway. The reason that he sent it to me is because my old card was starting to go out. A lot of graphical issues with Chrome and with transcoding with Plex. Now, this is an older graphics card that Bill sent me, but it's still extremely powerful. What was it? The Fire Pro 7100?
Yeah, W7100, I think.
Yeah, W7100. Now, I was able to get it set up with no real issues at first. The only problem that has come up is that there are not any OpenGL2 drivers available for it, and this has meant that I cannot run certain applications, but I will get back to that. Now, before the hard drive replacement, I was able to use the built-in backup tool from Mint to try that out and see how well things worked. I backed up my entire home directory using the tool and also was able to back up all of my applications. I did this because I really wanted to test out the restore process. The install went really well with the latest stable version of Mint. The restore went okay. Most of my applications were reinstalled so long as they were in the main repos. This meant that I had to manually install some of my applications, but for even most of those, the restore at least preserved my user data and settings. Of course, there are some that did not, such as Plex and Audio Bookshelf. I am still going to try and do a further restore of my Audio Bookshelf, since it takes a lot of work to manually fix all of the matches. And since I have the old hard drive, all of that data will be there, even if I can't find it in the backup that I made, because I also just manually backed up the entire home. Now, there were also quite a bit of resetup required with Nextcloud and all of my file automation, but none of that was, you know, excessively difficult. Just, you know, reinstalling Nextcloud and repointing it to the correct folders. Now, with the new graphics card, I was pleasantly surprised with how good Borderlands 2 looked playing from Linux on the card. None of that, you know, spending an hour trying to load the drivers. Now, much cleaner than the old one and nowhere near all the delays with opening. The only issue came up when I tried to run the app image for Cura, which threw an error about OpenGPL 2. Now, I did try to fix this by manually installing drivers from AMD, which did not install the way that they should, and I had to purge those changes. Thankfully, I still had an older version of the app image for Cura, which does not require the OpenGL 2 drivers. Also, with the attempted install of the AMD drivers, it broke my VM. Now, I tried to make sure that I have a good backup of my VM at all times, and I did a full backup right before the Nukem Pave. I had VirtualBox 7, which had worked for a little while, before the driver's gaff, but afterwards it was throwing errors indicating that some of the helper tools were the wrong version. So I ended up purging VirtualBox and installing version 6.1, which got everything up and running again, which is what I was using on the old install. Next came an issue with, well, I thought it was my USB switcher that was the problem. This is the device that I used to switch my keyboard and mouse back and forth between my work computer and my home computer. It would start out working just fine on a restart, and then one of the times that I would switch back, suddenly it would not connect, and I would not be able to connect any new USB device to my system. I tried switching out the cables, switching out the hub, even found a script to disconnect all the USB devices and reconnect them. Swapping sides on the switch, nothing worked except for restarting the entire system. But everything always worked fine on my Windows work computer. Now, I tried going into Solaire and disconnecting and reconnecting the mouse, and one time when I restarted the system, it showed that the Logitech receiver was causing an issue. In the end, I think that it was the new version of Solaire, or some configuration change that I made with the new version of Solaire, that caused the issue, because purging Solaire fixed the issue entirely. No problem since then. Now, I was on the New Year's HBR show, but for much less time than I would have liked. I really enjoy being on the New Year's HPR show, and I only got on there for an hour or two, but that's it's because my dog, Dysis, her health took a turn for the worse, and she died, and I just couldn't be on the show. And now, I had also had my first follow-up appointment since I started taking TRT. My testosterone numbers are actually worse. Like, they went down by 100 points. The doctor doesn't know what the heck is going on, but we have upped my doses for now and scheduled another appointment in 3 months. I also need to up the amount of cardio that I do and see if that helps improve my HDL. My LDL is within acceptable range, but my HDL is excessively low. Of course, moving on, it wouldn't be my bi-weekly wanderings without headphones and 3D printers. My 3D printer needed a bit of a tune-up, so I tightened all the belts and had to tighten the mount for the extruder. I also replaced the nozzle with a new one, as the old one seemed to be partially clogged. With the switching to the older version of Cura, I also needed to go into the settings again and make sure that the fan speed was set to 50% because of the fan cooler that I have on there now. This has greatly improved my print quality again. I have done a few prints since then, including a replacement PC slot cover, a buckle, and a sliding handle for X-Acto knife blade. The buckle I am planning to probably reprint after a bit of a redesign. There are some parts that I think could use some bulking up in order to make them a bit more durable. I also may scale it down for some of the applications that I have it in mind for. So that's my 3D printer. I'm quite happy with how it's performing now. A coworker has handed me a pair of Sony WH-1000 XM3s to try and fix, and they are a pain in the butt to work on. They're not hard to take apart or anything, but the fault is intermittent, and every time I take it apart and work on it, it starts to work again, only to stop a short time after I put it back together. Obviously, it is a short somewhere, but all the wires are well separated, and it is hard to tell where the fault is. I'm going to have to start peeling back shielding to find anything, and I know it's going to probably cause more problems than it solves. Granted, the thing is broken anyway, so what's the difference? What am I going to do? Make it more broken? Now, I did also get another portable screen. It was an 11-inch portable screen for Christmas, and I've used a tablet mount to put it on my chair in the garage. I've used it for my phone, since it also has a touchscreen, which is the main purpose that I had in mind for it, but I also decided to set up one of my Pi Zeros with a USB hat and RetroPie. I will say that it requires a special cable to hook to my phone, like USB-C on one side and like, what is it, Thunderbolt 3 on the other side to properly connect. So I can only use the cable that came with it. And if I'm only using USB-C instead of an adapter to HDMI, then it cuts out and it cuts back in. Even if I use a powered hub, it cuts out, it cuts back in. So I'll just continue using the adapter for it. Now, my other portable screen doesn't have that issue, but it only uses the adapter. Now, for the Pi Zero build with RetroPie, I only put a couple of my favorite games on there so that I can play a quick game whenever I'm not busy. Right now, I am working my way through completing a Super Mario Brothers speedrun. So, and probably also, you know, I have Shadowrun set up there and it will be able to run. And that 11-inch screen is really close to me and it's really nice to be able to have my controller there and set up. But I do have to work on my cable management for that. I have not figured that out yet. So right this second, it is disconnected, but I will be hooking it back up again this evening. And that's really all I have. Well,
so, well, real quick, okay. I'm looking at the Tech Power Up screen or website for the FirePro W7100, and it's saying it supports OpenGL 4.6. I don't know if that's a driver issue then, or I don't know, maybe try the AMD GPU Pro driver.
Like I said, I tried to install the drivers that AMD suggested, and they did not install correctly, and it broke everything.
Interesting.
And yeah, when I go and look at the drivers, it does say 4 something, but it's still considered OpenGL 1. I don't know why. And then when I go and look at what the most recent drivers are, it's like 6 something. So
yeah. Huh. Maybe it's something that'll... we can find a fix for at some point.
Maybe. Everything works. All I have to do is the older version of the app image for Cura works fine. If I come across any other OpenGL 2 problems, then maybe I'll start worrying about it. But for now, it's perfect. Eventually, one day, I'm going to need another graphics card again. But, you know, I'm not going to argue with free.
Yeah. And that's a fairly good card for the... For the money you paid for.
It's brilliant. It is a powerful card. It's just not getting driver updates.
Yeah, I had to look because it's actually showing the same version of OpenGL it supports as my Radeon Pro that I replaced that one with. And so it got me to thinking it's got to be a driver. It's got to be a Linux thing, maybe an app image thing. Have you tried something not containerized?
Not with Cura.
Yeah.
Basically, that's all they do.
Right on, Moss.
Okay. I have my new refurbished Pixel 7 all up and running. Didn't take much, just putting the apps on the phone and logging into them, then moving the SIM card. I'm so glad to have that Moto G Stylus 5G 2022 behind me. I had to cancel my annual trip to Atlanta so that I could take care of my wife who is recovering from knee replacement surgery. If I were in Atlanta, I wouldn't be here today. I am quite clearly missing being at the convention as being around so many friends playing so much music sets the tone for my year. Suzanne has the other knee scheduled for early February, so we'll be at this for a while and I can't work during this period. The 2016 System 76 Kudu 3 that I got from listener Jackie Moore years back has finally had a hinge break, also breaking some of the bezel on the screen. I'm planning on sending it to Joe for rest and recuperation. I now have the box and the padding all... together, I just haven't packaged it up yet. The good news is I finally got her to use the Lenovo ThinkPad T590 I bought her almost a year ago, although it does not like her monitor the same way the Kudu did. I am trying to talk her into getting either the Lenovo ThinkCenter Tiny or the equivalent HP machine, both of which continue to be very inexpensive on eBay. With the Kudu, when she'd open the lid, nothing would happen on her monitor, and when she'd close the lid, nothing would happen on her monitor. And with the T580, it blanks out for like 3 seconds each time. And it's already set to do nothing, quote unquote, but it's not doing nothing. Let's see. Jackie also offered to sell me a PineTab 2 at a very nice price, but my wife put that on hold for now. I hope I can loosen the purse strings up soon. I did spend quite a few hours on the HPR New Year's Eve show, although it was much less satisfying than previous years, as there were rarely more than three people actually talking, usually more like two. Last year, there were like three times as many people in the room at all times, and it was not that satisfying of an event this year. That's about really all I have. What?
It was just really strange. I kept trying to join, and I heard you and someone else speaking for a few minutes, and that was on my phone, and then I tried to get to my computer. When I came here to join, I joined via the link that was in the announcement, and it showed people in the room, but nobody was talking. All the microphones were blanked out, and I have no idea why, but I couldn't hear anyone or anything from that
point
forward.
There were large periods of time that nobody was saying anything. They were just there holding space.
Okay, well, maybe I just kept joining at the wrong time, but I joined probably 10 different times over that period, and yeah, there was just nothing, dead air. And so it was like, okay, well.
Yeah,
I thought I was having
the same.
Okay. Yeah, I just thought I was having a technical problem, but that's a shame. Okay.
All right, Majid.
Okay, so I've not been here for the last couple of weeks, so I suppose I've got a few more wanderings than usual. I got the MetaQuest VR 2 in a Black Friday deal. That's how long it's been since I've been on. To be honest, it's good, but it's a bit superfluous. Everything on it costs money. You want to play a game, it's £15. You want to do this, another £5, £10 this, whatever. Obviously, you know, it's very much a they're making the money on the content type of device. It is much easier than other VR things that I've used in the past. I remember using the original PlayStation VR 5, 6, 7 years ago now. It's still a little bit of a headache, you know, getting it up and going. So I'm actually tempted to, it's still within the extended return period, actually. So I might send it back, although my daughter really wants me to keep it. Part of the way that I'd convinced myself that when I bought that it wasn't a waste of money was that I could say to myself, well, at least I can watch TV on it. Well, our main LG 43-inch TV started dying, and so I looked around to see if there were any good Boxing Day sales around. And I managed to pick up a Hisense. I've never heard of the brand before, but I think it's a Chinese make. 55-inch, you know, 4K, ultra-high def, all the smarts things in it, for about $300, which I was quite impressed by. Good screens have become cheap, it seems, and cheap screens have become good. Will it have the longevity? I don't know. I mean, that LG had lasted, what, 8 years, I think? Sounds about right. 7, 8 years. Maybe this won't last as much, but for the price, I'm not going to say no to that. I've finally given up on Linux on a phone. After bricking a OnePlus 6 and almost bricking a Pixel 3a, I decided I've not got enough. I do not have the patience for this or the cognitive bandwidth. The biggest issue seems to be downgrading to Android 9. So I was trying to get UbiPorts, well, Ubuntu Touch, onto it. And one of the first, and it has its own installer that you can download, and you know, it works as a flat pack, and it doesn't know. It works as a snap or as a dev package. But the thing that it wants is that it wants you to downgrade your device to Android 9. Now, considering that, you know, the OnePlus 6 was on Android 11 when I got it, the Pixel 3a on Android 12, this was not as easy as I anticipated. And I thought actually I definitely did destroy the OnePlus 6, and I've had to just get rid of it. And I thought I'd also destroyed the Pixel 3a in the process as well. I was, however, able to unbrick it, if you want to call it like that, with the help of some people on XDA developers. And so I am now on principle going to leave this, because if you have to run through all these hoops, and okay, maybe I'm not the cleverest guy in the world, but I like to think that I know a little bit about technology. And if I'm having all these problems, then it's just not ready for prime time. And it's never going to be ready for prime time if this is the things. One of the other things I bought in the Black Friday sales was a GameSir X2 controller, which basically, so it's You know, like the Switch has the two the controllers on the sides, and there's a screen in the middle. So this basically works like that. You know, you put your phone in into it, and you've got the controllers on each side. And I play a few new games on it on my main phone, which is the OnePlus 11. But now that I've unbricked this Pixel 3a, which is I suppose extra in the house, I've thought of using it as like a dedicated Android games console. It's a little bit, it's a bit too old now for a lot of the kind of high-end games, but it runs emulations really well, so I'm using it as like a kind of like a retro console. Been putting on some old SNES ports, you know, Street Fighter 2, things like that, which has been good fun. I'm trying to see if maybe if I can get a PlayStation 4 emulator, because, you know, those games might be reasonably... No, you don't reckon?
The best you're going to do is PS1.
Really?
On that device, the best you're going to do is PS1.
Oh, okay. I thought, okay, PS2 maybe?
PS1.
Okay, fine. Fair enough. No worries. So... I don't. In the same way that Bill never mentions the fact that he uses Arch, I never mentioned the fact that I, you know, did a whole iPad Mac experience thing back in 2022-23. And, you know, it was a fail, as I've discussed here ad nauseum. And I don't want to necessarily go over through all of that. The TLDR, I suppose, being that tablets can't do laptop stuff as well, and laptops don't have the best battery life for tablet-y type stuff. And yes, I know the M1 MacBook Air had great battery life, and I did like that part of it, but the OS was a bit too limiting for a fast nerd like me. So the idea came to me whether an Android stroke Samsung ecosystem might work, since the Apple one didn't. The work phone is a Galaxy S22 Ultra, and so I thought if I get a Samsung tablet which supports DeX, maybe this might work. I'd get a kind of, you know, unified ecosystem thing, see if Samsung's is anything like Apple's, whatever. Anyway, I managed to get a Samsung Tab S6 Lite, which is the 2022 version of it, so slightly newer, off eBay for about 200 quid. It came, I got a Bluetooth keyboard from Amazon. I had to unlock and reset the machine myself, though, because although it had been factory reset by the seller, it still wanted the original lock code. So this, I think, is a thing that...
It's actually a Google thing. It's not an Android thing. It's a Google lock that they put on there that the person didn't reset it correctly or whatever to allow it for resale. And so they wanted them to log back into it.
Yeah, which is what they wanted to do. And the seller wouldn't, kept on saying, oh, I don't know what the PIN is and this, that, and the other. Even when I threatened, look, I'm going to return this or whatever. In the end, I found some software to bypass it myself. And I set it up and it's working fine. But I haven't pushed it too much. I think maybe it's a little bit underpowered, especially when you put it into DeX mode. It becomes into a kind of slowish laptop. And Android as a tablet OS isn't as limiting as iPad OS was. And I can still use it like a normal laptop, I suppose, especially with the DeX mode. But it's still early days. I do sometimes wonder whether, though, all of this is just a little bit me being a bit of a curmudgeonly old man. And whether it's all a little bit foolish, really. The reason I say that is because I've recently joined a Islamic organization, and we needed to make some posters advertising events. The other guys aren't so techie, so I was asked to make it. And I thought this would be, you know, get my you know, laptop out, or maybe use my desktop machine. I used, I remember, it's been a while since I've used it, but I used to use Scribus, which is an open source tool for making these kind of posters and stuff like that. So anyway, I thought, since I'm on this now Samsung experiment, as it were, I'd try this out. And so I thought, well, you know, let's have see what kind of apps there are out there for making posters and this, that, and the other. And I was basically able to do it all in about half an hour on my smartphone, so not even on the tablet. I didn't even have to load up on that. The S22 Ultra, the S Pen came really in handy, and I was able to make it within, you know, 20, 30 minutes. And, you know, the guys were really impressed and this, that, and the other. And made me wonder whether maybe I need to wake up and smell the coffee a bit and not try and shoehorn my old, you know, old kind of antiquated workflow paradigms and new hardware. Instead of trying to make... whether it's the iPad or whether it's a Galaxy Tab or whatever, work more like a laptop. why don't I just find different ways of doing things? Because it was so easy and so intuitive, and the pen, as I said, came in handy. But even if I didn't have the pen, it still would have been really easy. So maybe as I said, I just need to, you know, wake up to 2024 really. Christmas is quiet for us. We don't really celebrate it, to be honest. We've got two Eids in the year and the kids get enough presents for that. I'm not buying another load of presents for anything else. But we do spend a bit of family time. You know, went to my mother's, you know, sister came round, that kind of thing. We had planned a holiday initially, but we've had some recent bathroom and other DIY mess ups in the house. We had workmen around, and obviously I had a much lighter bank account. Yeah, which is going to get even worse actually, because January, the worst month. Anyway, the NHS strikes are still going on. The senior doctors, like myself, yes, I know it's hard to believe, but I am one of the attendings. I've been offered a pay deal, but the juniors haven't. It's the classic British divide and rule. I've got to be honest, I probably would actually go for the pay deal. It's not, I can see that I'm being played, but at the same time, it's a reasonable-ish offer. Anyway, I don't want to get into the intricacies of NHS contracts, but it does work out good for me. Although, as I said, I know exactly what the government is trying with this. I've been relatively quiet on the distro front. I've still got Ferron on this desktop, and I've got Ubuntu on the work laptop. Manjaro is still on. So yes, Bill, I can say I use Arch as well. I use that laptop less and less because battery life is pants. Even on Windows, it's just not very good. It's a bit embarrassing. It's got fun. It's a lovely screen. It's an Asus ZenBook. It's got a beautiful OLED screen and all that sort of jazz. But yeah, the battery life is terrible. I'm going on a spiritual retreat in Morocco in January. So unfortunately, I won't be on the next episode.
You're going to make another earthquake happen?
Oh, bloody well, I hope not. I mean, to be fair, it was a month after the earthquake. So, I mean, you know, didn't get me, I suppose. I'm a little bit apprehensive about it because it does sound very kind of teenage backpacky. Like when I've been talking to the other guys who are coming along, they're like, oh, yeah, we take the flight and then we get in a bus and it takes 4 hours to get out into the where we need to, and then we sleep on the mattresses in the main hall, and there's probably about 200 of us all together from different parts of the world. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm a guy that, you know, needs an ensuite shower and everything, you know. So I'm not entirely sure. It's character building, probably. That's probably the word I'm looking for. I mean, to be fair, it's only for basically a long weekend. We fly out on Friday, we come back on Monday, and a lot of it is going to go in travel. Let's see. It's not costing me that much either as well. Let's have a look. That'll be interesting. I don't want to get too political, but I just wanted to say that the whole situation in Israel-Palestine is really terrible. It kind of shows the cold-heartedness of all of our ruling classes. And I feel particularly bad and helpless about the whole thing. But one thing at least that helps me and, you know, deal with these kinds of things is to see what I can do and what I can change. And so, you know, if you can find any charities that affect anybody on either side, you know, please do. It's something that, you know, at least it will make us stop feeling so helpless in the face of all this kind of craziness that unfortunately we live in. Anyway, on that slightly somber note, I suppose I should hand over to Eric.
All right. Well, for me, the holiday season usually means time spent with my family rather than tinkering, and this year was no exception. I haven't done much recently, you know, like Majid said, I just really on the distro front or anything, I've just sort of been, status quo, I guess is the way to say it. But there was one thing that I was trying to do. I had some downtime where the family was out and I sort of was just sort of sitting around. I had my tablet computer with me and I was trying to get a piece of software for web development set up on my system, and they distribute it as a binary package on either the Snap Store or Homebrew. And I'd been looking for an opportunity to use Homebrew anyway, so I took this as the the opportunity to do that. So Homebrew is mostly seen as a Mac solution, but it also works on Linux and also Windows on WSL. But it's essentially another third-party package management solution, so like Snap or Flatpak. And in many cases, it's sort of redundant because a lot of the stuff that's in there is sort of the same. But in this case, this package that I wanted is called Hugo. It's a static website generator. Like I said, they chose either Snap or Homebrew, and I don't really use Snap, so Homebrew it was. And so basically, it just like any of those other software management systems, it lets you install and update and remove and just manage the software. What's kind of nice is that it installs packages to their own directory, and then it symlinks the files into like the opt directory so that your system has access to them. And so if you launch them from a command line or something like that, you can interact with them, but all of that stuff is kept separate. So not only does that keep it out of, mucking up your system, but also that makes it portable and you can choose where you store it and makes it very flexible. So I get the sense that this is maybe more of a developer focused solution, although they do have, Inkscape and GIMP and Audacity and sort of Firefox, just sort of all of the standard open source software as well. And I don't think that it's going to overtake using something like Flatpak or even AppImage necessarily, but it was easy to set up. I like that it keeps itself separate from everything else. And, that way it's not messing anything up. And if I choose to use it and then don't need what it has, I can either uninstall it or literally just delete the whole thing, which is nice. So that's really the only thing that I've done from a technical standpoint. And I'm sure, January getting back to real life that I'll start doing more and more things. But yeah, December is my opportunity to just sort of not do anything that I really don't want to do. So that's it.
Maybe one of our innards will be you talking about setting up Homebrew and using it and the benefits.
Yeah. Could be.
Okay. Well, that looks like it for our bi-weekly wanderings. So, all right. Moving on to housekeeping and announcements. Thank you for listening to this episode of Mintcast. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, tell us. Send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Join us live on YouTube. Post at the Mintcast subreddit. Chat with us on Telegram and Discord, or post directly at mintcast.org. Our next episode will be 2 p.m. U.S. Central Time on Sunday, January 21st, 2024. There is a link in the show notes to get that converted to your time zone. Next Roundtable live stream, 2 p.m. U.S. Central Time on Saturday, January 13th, 2024. There's a link in the show notes to get that converted to your time zone. Livestream information is available at mintcast.org/livestream. And if you like the sound of my voice, you can catch me on a couple of my other podcasts. I'm on the Linux Link Tech Show, which is tllts.org. I'm on Linux Lugcast, which is at linuxlugcast.com. Or you can send me an email, jb@mintcast.org. I do try to respond to all my emails. Or you can buy me coffee on Ko-fi. Link in the show notes. Moss?
You can hear me every week on Full Circle Weekly News. I've got DistroHopper's Digest coming out rather shortly. You can email me at bardmoss@pm.me. My Mastodon is at zyvola@hosttux.social. I used to say my other contact information could be found at itsmoss.com, but as Majid pointed out to me this morning, it is currently not working. So have fun. Bill?
Well, you can email me, you can email me, bill@mintcast.org. I'm bill_h on Discord. My Mastodon is at WCHauser3 at Fostodon. Also, check out my other two podcasts, Linux OTC and Three Fat Truckers. Links to both in the show notes. Majed?
So, you can get a hold of me on my email, drmajid@mincast.org. I'm still on Twitter, X, whatever, as atypicaldoctor870. Although, I've got to be honest, I'm thinking that's going to die soon, as in the account. I'm Atypical Doctor on Instagram and Threads, and there's the Atypical Doctor podcast on Spotify. Eric?
You can also hear and see me on DistroHopper's Digest and Linux OTC podcast, as well as Linux Saloon and Linux Lugcast streams. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, I can be reached by email at eric@mintcast.org.
Before we leave, we want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. Bill for our audio editing, archive.org for hosting our audio files, Hobstar for our logo, NitRD for the animated Discord logo, Londoner for our time sinks and various other contributions, Bill for hosting the server which runs our website, website maintenance, and the Nextcloud server on which we host our show notes and raw audio, and to the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about. Thanks, Clam.
Thanks, Clam.
And Co.
And Co. And that is a wrap. This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Join us in our Discord channel and our Telegram group. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. Thanks to Interfection for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of Mintcast.